Welcome if you're joining us for the first time. It's terrific to have you here, and hopefully you've come at the perfect time where some of the questions that perhaps you're asking, we're able to scratch tonight. The things that are questions that are itching, we'll be able to scratch. So the things are going to be a bit different. Normally when you turn up to a church service, there's a kind of a, 20 or 30 minute talk, and then but tonight I'm going to break it up into four small talks. So I'm about to start talking in a moment, and it'll only go for 3 minutes, and then I'll be back to you where in pairs or in however you'd like to sit. You can just chat about the question, the discussion question, like the first one in the first small group discussion will be, what's the social justice issue that's closest to your heart? So it won't be hard. Well, most of them anyway. Now, last night, I think if you don't know me, sorry, I should have introduced myself first. My name is Sam, and when I'm not here, I like to do fancy dress, and so that was me last night, going way out of my comfort zone, and I hate being the centre of attention, and my daughter insisted that when I went out, I go fancy dress, and so she got a measuring tape and put it around her neck and said, "Dad, I'm a fashion designer. I'm going to design your costume." And so she put that together for me, and we ended up winning first prize by accident. We won the group prize, even though we weren't even a group. So there you go, or not an intentional group. Now, Simmons just told you that we're doing three talks, and that's science, social justice, and then next week, identity. And so today we're at the second one. So making sense of God, and in a world where we're all passionate about social justice. Though right now, we're going to start with our first little talk, looking at the human longing for justice. Oops, I've got a phone. Yep. Right, it's okay. I'll get the headset my second and third and fourth talk. So I'll just, for 3 minutes, I'll live with a thing. Thank you. Cool. Where do these, who spoke these words? I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. 27 times. He said, "I can't breathe." Anyone know? George Floyd, thank you very much. So George Floyd was an African-American man who cried out, "I can't breathe," 27 times before finally suffocating to death. A white policeman brutally crushed him to death. He'd just been sitting in his car with two other mates, and they've just come out of the grocery store, and an employee in the grocery store had rung up the police and said she thought this black man African-American man outside had given her a counterfeit $20 note, and so the officers, three officers, turned up. They forcibly dragged him out of the car, threw him to the ground, and then one of them stuck his knee into his neck to forcibly restrain him. Two other officers also piled on to restrain him. But the crushing effect was that it cut off his oxygen supply. So George Floyd's pleas to the policeman went unheard. And after 9 minutes and 29 seconds, he died on the side of the street. Now, the incident was caught on camera, on a video, on a mobile phone. And when it was posted, it went viral right around the globe. And within days, thousands of protests across the world began. 15 million people alone marched in America. Thousands more marched in Germany, England, France, Israel, Australia, Asia, and even parts of Africa. Marches were held, statues were toppled, and voices were raised at the grievous violation of these civil rights. "I can't breathe," became the catch cry. A black man was unjustly killed by an aggressive white man. Now, why did the events of that day light a fuse around the world? The world, it was only 2020, and the world had only just plunged into lockdown for COVID. Everyone was still worried, and you know, there was a lot of fear in the air. There was no vaccine back there, no cure, and so everyone was isolating. And yet here people were marching by their thousands, by their millions, against this injustice. So why did George Floyd's death affect so many and so profoundly? Now, you probably think of many stories like it. Such stories fill us with anger, sadness. They motivate us to stand up against injustice, to speak up for what's right. Why is it that sometimes something inside us rages when we hear wrongdoing? Something inside us gets angry, rightly so, when we see racism. Police brutality is just repugnant to us. Well, Floyd's death gripped us because we humans are moral agents seeking righteousness and justice. One of the great civil rights activists, Martin Luther King, back in the 1960s, put it like this. He said, "We live in a moral universe. We live in a moral universe. That's where we live. We're more than just biological creatures, a random collection of chemicals. We live in a moral universe. That's why we care so much about justice. We all, no matter who we are, somewhere in the world, wherever we are in the world, we might disagree or different issues might grab us more than others. Everyone, deep in their hearts, longs for justice. We all long for social justice." Right, that's my 3 minutes. Now, we're going to break into small groups. So I have three more talks, but we're going to break into small groups now, and you can share your thoughts. And so feel free to just join in as you feel comfortable. You might want to speak a little, you might want to speak a lot, you might not want to speak at all. It's all okay. But the questions, that's all fine. The question for discussion up first is, yeah, which social justice issues are closest to your heart and why are you passionate about them? All right, I'm just going to give you 3 minutes now to chat with the people around you. You sort out your own groups. And I'll come back up here. I'm going to be a bit sharper on time this week in the small discussion groups, just because we don't want them to go too long. So I'll be back up in 3 minutes. All right. And Simon's going to time for me. Great. Go for it. Okay. Well, we'll pull it back there. And each time it's going to be frustrating because you could talk for hours and hours on these kind of topics. And especially when it's something you're passionate about and close to your heart. So It'll be a bit frustrating, but look, after the meeting today, you can talk to your heart's content. But we're going to move on now to the next step. And so we've all got a longing for justice, social justice. Well-known atheist, though, Christopher Hitchens, he sadly passed away a few years ago, but before he passed away, he was the author of a well-known book called God Is Not Great. Religion Poisons Everything was the subtitle. So God is not great, religion poisons everything. He kind of put the question to us, the argument that religion leads inevitably to violence. And so he wrote a chapter about, called Religion Kills. And he gave examples from across the globe of religious-fueled violence. Belfast, Beirut, Baghdad, Bethlehem. There's one in Ireland. What is it? I said Belfast, didn't I? Yes. Now, his argument was that religion takes racial and cultural differences and it aggravates them. It's like racism. He wrote, quote, one version of one religion inspires and provokes the other. And so he says, continues the quote, religion has been an enormous multiplier of tribal suspicion and hatred. And so if we think about it, well, there's lots and lots of truth. We can, as for those of you who are Christian here, we can be sympathetic with his argument. I mean, you think about it, in Japan, around the world, time of World War II, think about the totalitarian and militaristic Japanese Empire at the time. It grew out of a culture deeply influenced by Buddhism. Some of you are from India. You'll know the Hindu nationalists, in the name of their religion, carry out bloody attacks on the Muslims in the mosques and make life very hard. They even persecute the Christians too. Islam has been the soil for many terrorist attacks over the last 20-odd years since September 11. The Jewish-Israeli forces are often ruthless back towards the Muslims over in Palestine. And all of this is evidence to indicate that religion aggravates human differences until they boil over in violence, oppression, minorities, injustice, even war. And so we can sympathize with Hitchin, you know, the famous atheist, we can sympathize with his point. But we can agree that when a religion transcendentalizes ordinary cultural differences, that different parties will feel like they're in a cosmic battle of good and evil, even against each other. And so when one religion feels like they have the absolute truth, then all the others are wrong. And then that means that they will feel superior. But if someone feels superior, they might look down and be judgmental towards the other, which will then lead to intolerance. And that will then, like a domino effect, lead to oppression and injustice towards others. And in this case, people towards other religions. We've seen it time and time again in history. Now, if you're not someone who identifies as a Christian and you've been listening carefully, you might have noticed that I left one religion off the list from the examples above. I was a bit sneaky deliberately. The one religion not listed in any of my examples about the evils and injustices done in the name of religion was Christianity. But you might ask, well, isn't Christianity responsible? You might have heard it said, you know, isn't Christianity responsible for so much injustice as well? Well, that's a good point. And a fair question. And so in the next few minutes, I'll answer yes and no. What I'm going to do is assess whether Christianity, what we all need to do is assess whether Christianity has been a force for good and justice or for social injustice and evil, and then see what conclusions we can draw. Now, my answer will be that the short answer is that the answer to that question goes both ways. You can either argue either way. There's an enormous number of well-attested historical events and movements that can be used to either support a positive or a negative answer to that question. Has Christianity been a force for good or injustice? Certainly, violence and injustice in the name of Jesus is a terrible thing. That has happened down the centuries. And there's no excusing it. The church and Christians must both address it, we've got to face it, acknowledge it, and redress it. Make it right. You see, as Christians, as a church, we have to own the bad as well as the good things that have been done. One example is the African slave trade. I'm sure many of you will have heard of great champions of the Christian faith like William Wilberforce. Now, he was a truly great figure of history. He was the one in the mid-1800s who fought, basically fought his whole life to abolish slavery. Christians led the way to abolish slavery, motivated by his belief in Jesus. It was his faith and his morals that got him out of bed against enormous opposition for decades. Yet on the other hand, it was the nations influenced by Christianity that had created the African slave trade century beforehand. They institutionalized imperialism and violence and oppression. And sadly, in those earlier days, Christian scholars even used the Bible to support and defend the slave trade. See, there's other examples that can be argued both ways. Think of examples for the abuses against women and children within Christian institutions in the Western world. We're still paying for those sins here in the Tasmanian Anglican Church, selling off half our buildings. That's on the negative side. But on the positive side, well, it was also the influence of Christianity that inspired the first wave of feminists. Nations like New Zealand and Australia, back around the time of Federation, around the time of 1900, were also the first ones to give women the vote, equal to men. Nowadays, here in Australia, 23 of the top largest 25, so 23 out of the largest 25 charities in Australia are Christian. And so in summary, both good and justice, as well as evil and injustice, have been done in the name of Christianity too. And so let's acknowledge that. And so as we think about our longing for social justice today, the relationship between Christianity and social justice can't be answered by merely adding up a list of abuses and injustices on the one side of the sheet against the list of social goods on the other. That's too simplistic and can't conclusively prove either way. You see, even if the social goods do outnumber the abuses, and which I believe they do, and I wish I had more time to tell you and explain it all. The issue is that the wrongdoings often lodge more deeply in people's memories. And so we'll need to look elsewhere to get to the bottom of an answer, making sense of God and social justice. But our next question will be, well, perhaps if religion has been caused great injustice and oppression and violence and in the world, does secularism, a world without God, does that provide a better support for social justice? We'll think about that over the next couple of talks. And so I'm going to put the ball over into your court again. Now it's your turn to break up into your little groups and have a think. Everyone's free to share their own opinion. We don't want to stifle anyone. So again, just join in as you feel comfortable. But the question will be, well, given the history of religious intolerance and injustice, would the world be a better place, a world of social justice, if we didn't have God? Okay, I'll give you 3 or 4 minutes to think about that. All right. Well, I hope that was a stimulating discussion. So we all have a longing for justice, for social justice, and history shows very mixed results for religion. Well, what about secularism? A world without God, is secularism the answer? Would we be better off without God at all? Does secularism provide a better support, a better basis for social justice? Many people today adopt a secularist view of the world, a view of the world without God. Many also think that a commitment to human rights is just a basic part of the secularist view of things. But again, history demonstrates otherwise. You see, like religion, secularists haven't got a very good track record of upholding human rights and delivering social justice. Upholding human rights and social justice has actually got a troubled relationship with secularism as well. You'll all be familiar with examples of modern versions of secularism. Let me spell a few out. You see, the communist Russian, Chinese, and Cambodian regimes that we've seen over the last 100 years, they all rejected belief in God. Even the French Revolution back at the end of the 1700s was like a forerunner. They too rejected religion, traditional religion, for human reason. These societies all consider themselves rational and secular. Yet despite their commitment to atheism, history shows that they produced more violence and more death, not against the other side, but even against their own people, than all the previous centuries combined. It's extraordinary. You see, for all the claims of human progress, the atrocities of the last 100 years, thanks to secular atheists, ought to leave us with a lump in our throat. In World War I, 20 million people died in the Great War. Only 20 odd years later, 75 million died in World War II. Hitler killed 7 million Jews alone. Over in Russia, Lenin's Marxist revolution led to the deaths of 8 million citizens of the Russian Empire, some by starvation, some by torture, others by execution. After Lenin came Stalin. He killed another 9 million more. In fact, Stalin, in 1 3-year period, killed 750,000 people in the Great Purge. Now, you compare that to, say, the Spanish Inquisition. The church is known for the Spanish Inquisition. Well, that killed 5,000 people, 5,000 over 350 years. Here, Stalin kills 750,000 in 3 years. Chairman Mao killed 45 million in a purge lasting 5 years. These are his own people. Mao believed it was progress. Mao literally said, it's a great leap forward. And so history shows the last century of atheistic secularism has caused, in fact, unparalleled violence and murder and injustice. These secular atheists, these communist regimes, just made exactly the same mistake as all the religious oppressors. You see, when the idea of God's removed, something simply replaces it for him. Secularist societies just make something else transcendent, make something else absolute. And so some other concept becomes absolute. And so that's the value that they hang on to. They've got it. Others don't. Anyone that dares disagree with them or question them doesn't. And so suddenly they feel morally superior and become judgmental and intolerant of anyone who dares disagree. So the Marxists in Russia made the state the absolute. The Nazis made race and blood the absolute value. A few hundred years earlier, in the French Revolution, even freedom, the idea of freedom and equality, were used to oppress opponents and justify violence. Let me quote Madame Roland from the French Revolution in 1793. Madame Roland had established herself as one of the leading political figures within one of the more moderate revolutionary factions. And so she was known for her intelligence, for her astute political analysis, and her tenacity, and as a good lobbyist, as a negotiator. She was, yet even she went to the guillotine on trumped up charges. Now, before her death, she knelt down in front of the statue personifying liberty or freedom in the place of the revolution. She said, "Liberty, freedom, what crimes are being done in your name?" See how freedom became like God and was used as a weapon against her because she didn't agree with the other faction's ideas about freedom. Now, I think we're actually perhaps seeing a similar trend in our own postmodern secular culture in the last decade, 10 to 15 years. With this trend, we're seeing a trend towards the same thing. It's a new form of absolute moralism, or moral absolutism, in the form of cancel culture. And so in the name of freedom and equality and tolerance, dissenters, anyone who dares question or disagree with certain ideas, are silenced. Social media is used to shame people from the other tribe. And legislation is being used to coerce people to do or not to do certain behaviours outside the narrative. And so the so-called tolerant ones who champion freedom and equality in our culture are intolerant of the so-called intolerant ones. And so they cancel them. And so sadly, you talk to a few of the older people here, what we're seeing now in our culture, in our societies, Western societies, we just haven't seen before. In the last 15 odd years, we've started to see our culture, our society is dividing. More and more, it's becoming tribe against tribe. There's a lot of heat, not much light. I don't know about you, but I just find watching the news these days just exhausting. I'm just exhausted by all the rage. Everything's an outrage. 20 years ago, the tone was a lot more respectful. I mean, there was still debate and robust debate, but politicians and activists, they agreed to disagree with their opponents. Now they just simply want to destroy one another. See, something's happening. We all have a longing in our for social justice deep in our hearts. We've been thinking about, in this little talk, about, well, is eradicating God the answer to delivering justice for all? My bottom line was that, well, the history of secularism is equally as bad as the religious history, if not worse. They've been just as oppressive as the societies and regimes that have been religious. The secularist regimes have simply created their own version of moral absolutes, again leading to intolerance, marginalization, oppression, violence, and death. And so where I want to get everyone to, well, my argument so far is whether the people are religious or irreligious, whether they're individualistic or hierarchical, or whether it's socialist or capital or right-wing or left-wing, it makes no difference. The controlling, the domineering, the oppressive impulse. Doesn't matter which tribe or you come from. It seems to be deeply rooted in every human heart. And so, again, in my next fourth and final talk, we need to kind of approach the whole thing from a different angle and explore, well, is there a better grounds, a better basis to explain social justice? Are there better grounds to explore the relationship between God and faith and social justice? We'll think through what is the best way to justify human rights and uphold social justice. Right now, you can break back up into your groups, and the next questions will come up onto the screen. And the questions are, why are humans valuable? Why? What makes humans valuable that they should have human rights? So why are humans valuable, and how can you justify human rights? I'll give you 3 to 4 minutes, and then I'll call you back. Okay, I'll draw back there. So we're now going to think about which worldview provides the best basis for understanding and upholding human rights and social justice. There's a well-known phrase, a society should be judged by how it treats its weakest members. The society should be judged by how it treats its weakest members. Now, in the wake of World War II in 1945, the UN, the United Nations, was formed. Then 3 years later, in 1948, all the countries got together and they put together the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So it was written in the shadow of evil, of Nazism. They thought, well, never again should we allow that evil to happen. So let's put together a document articulating a list of human rights. And so the Declaration articulated the dignity, quote, the dignity and worth of the human person and in the equal rights of men and women. Now, this document, this declaration, was fantastic on the what? A great list of human rights. But in the last, how many years later are we now? 60, 70, I lose count. But A common criticism has been that it's great on the what, but it failed on the why. Well, why should people have human rights? Sure, you don't want to be like the Nazis, but is that the best kind of explanation we can give? Just be the opposite of that. Nazi Germany. And so this Declaration of Human Rights from the UN proclaims an admirable vision of human rights and social justice for all, but it's largely groundless. It provides no basis. Now, that perhaps reflects the average person today. If you ask them, well, do you believe in human rights? Their answer will be, well, of course, naturally. But then if you ask them, well, why? Well, I'll probably reply to you, well, what are you, some kind of Nazi? It's just like, well, it should be obvious. But is it obvious? You see, we need a solid basis for our longings for human rights. Otherwise, our longing for social justice, in fact, doesn't make sense. And so is there a way to justify human rights? And if yes, well, is there a belief system? Is there a worldview? Which belief system, which worldview best grounds and supports them? Now, most secular thinkers, these are the top ones, argue that human rights, the reason that people should have the right not to be murdered, for example, is based on people's capacities or capabilities. Most commonly, the top sort of secular scholars will say that human beings have rights because of their ability to reason, their human reason, and their ability to reason and make choices. But think about that. If that's the basis of why someone should have rights, then there's very serious problems, because if it depends on their human reasoning, their ability to choose, well, what about a newborn baby? It's got the capacity built into it, but it's not developed. What about a person in a coma? What about a very old person, like someone with dementia? What about someone that's mentally impaired with Down syndrome? Should they have human rights? See, on this main secular theory these days, defining and grounding human rights, the very young and the mentally disabled and the very old, well, they have none. Yet I'd hope that we all agree in this room that all these persons, even without the full capacity perhaps that adults have to reason, that these people still have rights. I hope you agree with me that they have rights. The Down syndrome person has rights not to be murdered and tossed into a dumpster. Now you might think, well, that's silly to kind of talk like that, of course. And no one's going to violate someone's rights. But historically, that's not been the case. Go back to ancient Rome, you know, in the time of the early church. Unwanted babies, they were just left out, literally put on the dump, left out to die. They were left out to be exposed to the elements in the dumps. Thankfully, the Christians often went and picked them up and took and dropped those babies, unwanted babies. But it's not just an ancient issue either. You see, I think we're seeing the same thing bubble up and pop up again in even our modern culture. I don't know if you're aware or even if you'll agree with me, but many states around Australia have now legalized full-term abortions. Babies of up to 36 weeks. Atheist Richard Dawkins caused a stir, a big stir on Twitter in 2014. A woman had posted on Twitter, she said, that she'd be posed with a real ethical dilemma if, whether to abort or not, if she discovered that, if she discovered Down syndromes in any future pregnancy of hers. Now, Dawkins jumped online on Twitter and said, well, abort it, try again. Abort it and try again. And then listen to this second line. He went on, he said, it would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have a choice. It would be immoral to bring a Down syndrome baby into the world if you have a choice. That's Richard Dawkins for you. Now, he's a high-profile atheist sort of thinker, and but now some people might dismiss him and say, well, he's not, you know, he's got some out-there views. But Peter Singer, Australia's most high-profile philosopher, right, from the Melbourne of Uni, now at, I think he's at Yale University, he's our greatest thinker, a utilitarian philosopher. He believes in infanticide. He argues for it. That is not just at the end of birth when the baby's still in the womb, but even after it's born. That it's okay to kill it if it doesn't have the full capacities and never will. And so we have this contradiction in our culture. On the one hand, we say that a society should be judged by how it treats its weakest members, and we believe in human rights for all and in social justice. But on the other hand, in practice, and our society is legislated for full-term abortions. Unthinkable just a decade or two ago. See, our society in practice today is no different from the ancient Roman culture, which says we're all better off without the weak. And so it's precisely because we have these contradictions in our society, that these inconsistencies, that we actually really need to think through issues, and that we need to think through what we believe, because we need a solid basis, including for human rights and social justice. Otherwise, it'll just, you know, flip and flop. Our culture will flip and flop. We'll flip and flop with whatever's the latest fad. You see, we need to know which belief system, which worldview best grounds and supports human rights and social justice. Let me tell you this. I want to argue that the reason that we as a culture even believe in human rights and compassion for the weak and the vulnerable is because of the Bible. Sure, the Christians may not hold high political positions anymore. The Christianity is out of favor. That's okay. That's the way actually it's been for most of world history and most parts of the world. But Christianity's influence is still everywhere. Others have taken our values and argue them, but they've lost connection with where they came from. And in fact, they even use those same values to argue against Christianity, the very place they got them from. You see, around the globe and down the centuries, the vast majority of cultures have considered that we'd be better off without the weak in our society. But it's been the influence and impact of the Bible's message that has given us compassion, human rights, and social justice. Because the Bible is a story about a God of justice. It's connected to his love. That's why we get angry when we see wrongdoing, because we love people. We don't want them to be hurt. The Bible reveals that God from beginning to end is one who cares for the weak, the powerless, the marginalized. We see that in the way he delivered his own people, the Israelites, in the Old Testament, he delivered them from political slavery. We see it in the way that God used in the Old Testament women, marginalized women, to achieve his great plans, to bring the king of the world in. We see it in the way Jesus, in his life, God in the human body, during his life, always included the outsiders. And in fact, the insiders, the Pharisees gave them a, spoke the hard words to them. But the ultimate example that God cares for social justice in the world, in this world, his world, is through the way he became a man, Jesus Christ. And not just that. You see, God himself, in the person of Jesus Christ, showed that he stands with the weak, the powerless, the vulnerable, the victims of injustice, by himself becoming weak, powerless, vulnerable, and a victim of injustice. The message of the Bible is that Jesus was the only founder of a major religion who died in disgrace. He wasn't surrounded by all his loving friends and family. He was actually abandoned by all those that he loved. He was then the victim of a miscarriage of justice. He was murdered on trumped up false charges. He died violently, oppressed, helpless, naked, penniless. And think about how his salvation to us, it came, his salvation for all people, included all people from every part of the world, especially the poor and the oppressed. But think about how his salvation came. It came through poverty. Jesus' own poverty and rejection and weakness. And so Christ and his cross is the key to understanding, making sense of God and social justice. It's in that story of Christ and his cross that the cycle of oppression is broken. It's the story that stops his followers who were once oppressed from rising up and then wanting to become dominant, powerful oppressors themselves, like every other group in the world has in history. You see, Christians, true Christians, know that God, what Jesus did on the cross, God was doing for them. True Christians know that in the eyes of the all-powerful God, that we who were spiritually poor and powerless, we who were spiritual slaves and refugees, we have been saved by God's compassionate humbling of himself, by God becoming oppressed on the cross. We Christians know we have a God who died for his enemies, like we once were. And so likewise, we ought to live a life now of compassion, to love our enemies, to be compassionate towards the weak, the oppressed, and the vulnerable ourselves. It's good enough for our God, our Lord, to be a servant. Well, it's good enough for us. Those stains on the church's history that I talked about in the second talk, where some have exercised, like slavery, where some Christians have exercised domination, power, control, and perpetrated awful injustices. They failed to be Christian. See, they failed to be Christian enough. They fell very short of the Bible standard. But the Bible teaches that every human being is made in the image of God. That's what makes them valuable. That's what makes them worthy of love and care and compassion, because they're a reflection of God himself. Not because of their ability, it's because they're godlike.
whether they're male or female, black or white, rich or poor, slave or free. Every human is valuable. Every human being is worthy of love and care and compassion, whether they're young or old, able or disabled, smart or sick, straight or gay, religious or not religious. Every human is valuable. Every human being is worthy of love and compassion. It's because we're made in the image of God that we have a basis for human rights. That's where the concept came from. The Bible's teaching that all people are made in the image of God has given the world, the Western world in particular, this concept of human rights. And so now, if you're a Christian here, God calls you to be an agent of social justice in his world. And so I want to argue today, Christian, you'll be able to ask questions in a moment, but I want to argue that Christianity provides us with a robust basis for human rights and social justice. So if you're not someone here today that identifies as Christian, I want you to encourage you to explore this, what the Bible says about God, about Jesus and how he died on the cross. Here's some great books. There's one called The Air We Breathe, How We All Came to Believe in Freedom, Kindness, Progress and Equality, written by an Australian and plugged by lots of Christian and not Christian sort of cultural and historical commentators. It goes through all those sort of common values. There's another couple of books written by the same person called Timothy Keller. He's also fantastic. He's got two books. One was a bestseller on the New York Times called The Reason for God, Belief in an Age of Skepticism. And he answers all sorts of hard questions about, you know, can there just be one true religion? How could a good God allow suffering? Isn't Christianity a straitjacket? How could a loving God send people to hell? And so on and so forth. So he answers lots of those hard questions. Then there's, but maybe you're not quite at that stage and you want to know why you should even be bothered with religion or Christianity, even in the first place. And so he wrote another book called Making Sense of God, which is where I flogged today's title from. And he goes through, Tim Keller goes through, and he looks at how, whether it's meaning or hope or our identity or justice or whatever it is, that ultimately Christianity, the Bible, Jesus is the best explanation. And so check out, or perhaps those books, or read the Bible yourself. Read about Jesus. He was God in a human body. God makes sense of social justice, and social justice, I argue, only makes sense with God. Right, we're going to take a break there, and I'm going to invite Eve Poland to come up to the front, and she's going to share her experience. She's very passionate about social justice and hasn't always been a follower of Jesus either, so has come to faith later in life. And so welcome. Let's put our hands together for Eve. Now, Eve, I've known you for about, I don't know, 4 or so years, and ever since I've known you, I know you've been passionate about social justice issues. So which issues have been closest to your heart?
There's a lot, and I suppose they sort of all have different titles, but it's really just, do you care about people? But I suppose homelessness and sustainability are sort of the two really big ones. But also I feel like if I watch the news more that I would find out about so many others, and so I kind of just stick to a manageable chunk.
Yeah, that's right. We're not God, we can't do everything. Exactly. But we can, you know, we're often got a passion on our heart and we can do our one thing, and you know, everyone's wired differently, and so all the chess pieces are covered, you know, after everyone you know, puts into action their faith and champions their social justice cause. Tell us, how has your faith, your Christian faith, inspired you to work for just social justice? Because was it something you had before? Like, did you have this passion before you became a Christian? And then how has being a Christian changed your passion for these things?
Yeah, so particularly sustainability is something I've cared about for a really long time. And I think when I became a Christian, I thought, oh, well, now I need to give all that up and become a missionary or something. But I realized that, you know, God has given me these passions for a reason, and that he has a plan for me that uses those. Like, he made me that way. He knows what I care about. And I've just seen so many times how he's put things in place for me to walk that path. And so I think it's not so much, you know, this, I'm a Christian now, I'll do that. It's more this continuous feedback loop of just praying, you know, God, your will be done. And then crazy things happening. And it's like, okay, cool. All right, we'll go and do that. I think this is what God wants me to do. So I'm just going to try my hardest and leave the rest to him. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yes, is there anything else you want to sort of say? So
I guess I have, so having worked in the sustainability team at UTAS, I have a lot of friends in that area that are not Christian. And I guess I just see the weight on their shoulders so much. Them thinking they have to do it all themselves. So I think, yeah, my faith makes me feel like God has set out the path. I just have to walk it.
Yep.
And that's very freeing. And, yes, you know, if God wants me to solve some carbon dioxide issue or not, that's not really up to me. I just have to take the next step and trust him.
Yes.
And that gives me a lot more energy.
Yes.
And a lot more joy, yes, I think, compared to some other people in this kind of social, yes, justice area.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because if the world goes wrong, it's their fault. Like, they're to blame.
Yeah. And
they
have
responsibility because they
enough.
Haven't.
Yeah.
They haven't solved it. Whereas for you, you know, you can know your limits, and ultimately, it's God's in control and his, yeah, responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, all right. Thanks. Cheers. Great. What's the time now?
It's time for Q&A.
How many minutes do we have?
Maybe 5 minutes. Let's go 5 minutes.
Sure.
I hope you've got the questions ready for us. What I'm going to do is I'm going to walk around and hand you the microphone, and you could just, yep, raise your hand. I'll come to you with your question.
Ian, you always have hard ones for me. Thanks, mate. Oh, shivers.
So this is kind of an argumentative question.
Yep, good.
What you said.
Yeah, great.
So
go for it.
Earlier you said that God loves whether you are straight or gay,
yes,
or et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
So in the Bible itself, it condemns the same-sex relationships.
Yeah.
For an example, it's in Leviticus chapter 18, verses 22.
Yes.
It says that, do not practice homosexuality. Having sex with another man as with a woman is a sin.
Yeah.
So it means that it condemns same-sex relationships, or it condemns the LGBTQ community.
Mm.
And when we talk about human rights,
yeah,
it, this particular phrase itself, it breaks around like article number 1, article number 2, and article,
yeah,
number 3, which is basically like justice, equality, and dignity.
Yep.
And we, as the Christian community, we usually take the LGBTQ community as a criminal.
Yes.
Or as a murderer. Sometimes they say that, oh, you're a lesbian or a gay, you go to this hell straightforward.
Yep.
Which gives, like, which makes the community as more sinful. But what does it say right now? Because most of the community thinks that it's a sin. But when God itself says something like this, it gives a problem, it gives a question to themselves.
Yeah. I'll try my best. I'm not sure if I've understood your question perfectly, but the way I'll answer is by saying we're all sinners, so we're all equal before God. Now, some people have some sins, other people have other sins, but we're all sinners before God. And God has sent his son into the world because he loves the world, full of sinners. Every single person is a sinner. But God also desires that every person turn back to him and have a close, loving, intimate relationship that will love him and, you know, people will love others and look after the world. So that's God's design. That's why he sent Jesus to die on the cross. And so, so we're all sinners. We have different types of sins. So we're all equal before God in terms of being equally sinners. And we all equally approach God in the same way, whether we're this kind of sinner or that kind of sinner. And so so we all are saved by trusting and obeying Jesus and following him. It's because of Jesus' good works that we're saved, not because of our good works. So and so even in the church, like 1 Corinthians, in the letter of 1 Corinthians, in the church of Corinth, which is in Greece, 2,000 odd years ago, their culture was exactly the same as ours, exactly the same. And yet in that church, there were all sorts of people. There were greedy people, like we all are. There were drunken people, like, you know, many of us probably drunk too much at some point of our life. There were you know, people who'd commit every type of sexual sin, but yet it says they all now had a good relationship with God. Sorry, even included that Corinthian church, people who had practiced homosexuality. But now the homosexuals, along with the greedy and the drunkards and the people, you know, every type of sin, they were all now in a good relationship with God, because they had been made right through Jesus dying for all their sin, taking all their sins away, past, present, and future. They were washed clean by God's Holy Spirit coming to live in them and change their hearts. So it doesn't matter what kind of sinner we are, we're all equal before God in our standing, and we're all saved the same way. And whether I'm straight or whether I'm gay, the same response to God demands the same response of me, to put my faith in Jesus, to repent and obey. Yeah, does that make sense? Maybe I'll come back to you after and just clarify the issue.
Any other question?
Stephen and Yen?
this is personal, so but I'm wired up for this one. in Micah 5:8, it says that, you know, we should do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly before God.
Yeah.
If in your own Christian community you would deny justice, should you just walk away quietly and leave it to God? Or should you call it out and make a fuss?
Yep. I want to say that it's case by case. Sometimes in some situations, we work for change by subtly trying to change things from the inside. Sometimes from the inside, we call it out. You know, we name it. Other times it's just so bad and we're not in a position to influence, and perhaps destroying us mentally or in any other way, and the best thing to do is just walk away. And so, you know, down Christian history there's a million examples, and you can see all those kind of
those three ways of subtle change, naming it, exposing it, or separating. Right. I hope we're not the problem, but come and talk to me if we are. Yen, did you have a question? Sure.
Cool. One more question.
Feel free to come and chat to me after. Oh, yep.
Hello.
How are you?
So you said before that a secular society was a godless society, I think is the word that you used.
Their worldview is that God... Sorry, so there's a difference between the word secular and secularist. I used secularist, not secular. But yep, go on.
Okay, that's my question.
Yes, so
what I meant was that like a secular society isn't an atheistic society. It's more of a secular society more means that there's lots of different faiths within that society, including atheism, and you can really choose what faith you want. Whereas a godless society or an atheistic society, that would be more like maybe the communists. There is a difference between those.
There is a technical difference, and I tried my best to always say secularist and secularism. Yeah. Secular just means of this world. So we Christians, every Christian believes in a secularist society because we believe in living in this world, this physical real world. We don't want to detach from it in any way, and it will be mixed and shared. But secularism is a philosophy or an ideology where you're committed to only the things of this world, and the outside world the supernatural and is non-existent, to the best of my understanding. But if you're
I guess my direct question was I think I said to the group here, it happens to be that if you look at the world, we live in a liberal democratic country, which is in contrast to countries like North Korea.
Yes.
And it happens to be that these liberal democratic countries or secular societies happen to coincide with countries that have historic Christian roots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So Australia, the United States, Western Europe.
Yes.
So I'm going to imagine that you don't think this is a coincidence.
Absolutely not. No. So, I mean, that's the whole point of that book here. This one, The Air We Breathe, how we came to believe in... how we came to believe in equality, compassion, consent, enlightenment, science, freedom, progress. It was Christianity that laid the foundations. And, you look... And there's many ancient cultures like, Hindu India and the Buddhist countries and the animists and so on and so forth. But if you looked at which nations have been the most prosperous and most advanced and most just and most compassionate and things like that, it seems on the historical evidence that Christianity has brought the most fruit and light. So that's what this book sort of shows, that that actually all the things that many of us want now, it's got Christian roots. But even in our secular society, there's many now who are pushing for secularism and trying to exclude faith from the public square. But what I'm arguing is, they've stolen all the Christian values. They're twisting them a bit and then using it against us. Push us out of the public square.